Bad Quaker Podcast, where liberty is our mission. Today is Friday, August 9th, 2013. My name is Ben Stone, and this is podcast number 338. But I'd like to get you to think about the year 1549, if I could. Now, to get you to think about the year 1549, let's talk about some things that were going on in the 1500s, so you kind of get a sort of a perspective of what was happening in 1549. In 1519, Leonardo da Vinci died. In 1531, 1532, the Church of England broke from the Roman Catholic Church and recognized Henry VIII as the head of the church. 1537, the Tyndale Bible was first published in English. And in 1539, Hernando de Soto explored inland North America. He's the one that went out through the Great Plains and negotiated the traveling across the Great Plains like if it was an ocean, because the sky was so, you know, big and huge and there was no mountains to see in any direction. So he used the stars in the sky to navigate across the Great Plains. 1553, Mary Tudor became the first Queen Regent of England and restored the Catholic Church to its former position. 1554, Shakespeare was born. 1564, Galileo was born. And where would we be without Galileo? Well, let's see. We wouldn't have the lyrics for some cool Queen music, would we? Okay, so 1565 was the founding of the oldest European city in North America, and that would be St. Augustine, Florida. So 1565, about the same time Christianity was being introduced to Florida, the legendary Jesuit missionary Francis Xavier established a Christian church in Japan in 1549. Eventually, all of the European missionaries were expelled from Japan, and Christianity was outlawed under the penalty of death. So Christianity went underground in Japan for about 250 years. But you know, with the modern reforms and by the early 1900s, the Japanese Christians had emerged from hiding, and with private local funding, they built the massive St. Mary's Cathedral, completed in 1917. So now we're out of the 1500s, and we're in 1917 with the completion of this huge St. Mary's Cathedral. And you know, again, you can see that outlawing something doesn't make it go away. Because ideas outlive laws. You can't just outlaw an idea or a belief. It has to run its course. So now today, again, is August 9th, 2013. Early in the morning of August 9th, 1945, a Lutheran chaplain stood beside a Catholic chaplain on a runway on a small island in the Pacific Ocean. And these guys said prayers and blessed a B-29 Superfortress and its all-Christian crew. At 11:02 a.m. local time, that crew dropped a plutonium bomb on Nagasaki, Japan. The bomb was the second atomic bomb that had, as its target, a civilian population. The city of Nagasaki contained the largest Christian population of any city in Japan, and the ground zero target used to identify where the bomb should explode was the largest cathedral in Eastern Asia, St. Mary's Cathedral. On that morning of August 9th, some 6,000 Christians were attending Mass when the sky directly over them ignited with twice the heat of the surface of the sun. Along with those attending Mass that morning, three orders of nuns, and all the children in the girls' school were turned to carbon vapor, bringing the immediate death toll to some 8,500 of the church's 12,000 members. More would die later from the lingering effects of the blast and the radiation. The target committee in Washington, D.C. had made a list of Japanese cities that were to be excluded from the napalm firebombing campaign that burned over 60 Japanese cities to the ground during the first half of 1945. That list of protected cities included Hiroshima, Niigata, Kokura, Kyoto, and Nagasaki. These cities were off limits from the incendiary terror bombs, but preserved as targets for a new gimmick weapon, as it was called. These cities were chosen out of scientific curiosity. The scientists wanted to know what would happen to real buildings with real living inhabitants when atomic weapons were exploded over their heads. A lot of people have debated back and forth about the effectiveness, the morality, the military utilitarianism, all this, different issues have been argued back and forth as to whether it was good or proper or bad or a mistake to bomb Nagasaki and Hiroshima like they did. Well, I can kind of, when you're thinking about the arguments for whether or not to cook close to 200,000 humans, and in addition to that, kick-starting a Cold War that would last about 50 years, when you're thinking of the arguments in favor of that activity, it kind of boils down to two arguments. One would be the argument of, well, they started it. Now, for me, this was the hardest argument to overcome in my own mind. It took a long time and a lot of struggle with me before I could set that argument down. Because the way I feel, you know, if I'm walking down the street and somebody walks up and punches me in the nose, then the fight has begun and the fight's not done until I say it's done. Because when someone initiates the aggression against me, then rightfully I have, I may not be strong enough or I may not be, you know, I may not have the ability to fight back in the way that I would like to. I may be old or I may be broken down or I may be, you know, the initial strike might kill me or hurt me to the point where I can't fight back. But, as far as what's right and what's wrong, when someone initiates the aggression towards me, then I have the right to continue the fight until I am satisfied with the results. So, for a long time, when I would consider this argument in my mind, I justified anything and everything that might happen, after Pearl Harbor as saying, well, they started it. If they didn't want this to happen, they shouldn't have started it. But there's some problems with that. With that argument. First off, there's an old dead Greek dude that once said, in war, truth is always the first casualty. Now, if we set aside all the facts of history leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor in 1941 and assume the typical Forrest Gump view of history that Americans love to believe in, then the concept of dropping an atomic bomb on cities was justified because they started it. This is the collectivist argument. Now, if I threw you off there, if you're a new listener, if you're unfamiliar with my work, the Forrest Gump view of history that I was referring to there, let me explain that very quickly. You know, if you watch the movie Forrest Gump, he walks around through the movie and he's telling the story. And as he tells the story, he'll get to key events in history. Like, for example, he was talking about the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and he said one day he was riding in his car and they shot him, and then later on they killed his brother too. Must be hard having a brother. And that simplistic way of looking at things, you just ignore all the outlying facts, you ignore all the reasons and all the logic that goes with it, you ignore everything and just put it to simply somebody was walking along and something happened, and then off we go with the next thing. And this was kind of Forrest Gump's take when he described being in Vietnam and being wounded. He's in the middle of this firefight. There's bullets flying everywhere. There's shrapnel. There's explosions happening. And he says, you know, basically he's walking along in the jungle, and the jungle came up and bit him. And then that, you know, that's how he explains it. He just, yep, that happened. Or he explains the, you know, the death of Martin Luther King. For no good reason whatsoever, they just shot that man. Well, if you take that simplistic view of history, that's kind of the American way of looking at everything. We were just walking along one day, and all of a sudden, they just blew them buildings right up, and we called it 9/11. And that's the kind of mentality that Americans hold in their minds about events. But that's a lie. It's simply not true. And then when you take that lie and you apply to it the collectivist argument of blaming an entire society of people because what a very small handful of people actually did, then you come up with a justification like, well, they started it. Well, no, they didn't start it. You see, if the women, the children, the elderly, the nurses, the priests, the monks, the merchants, the teachers, the farmers, and the artists of Nagasaki deserve to be cooked alive because the government of Japan attacked the U.S. government naval base at Pearl Harbor, then by that same logic, every American is guilty of the murder by drone of the 16-year-old American boy who was blown to bits when a Hellfire missile struck him in a restaurant simply because he may have grown up to be a bad man. And according to that logic, every American is also guilty of the deaths of all the other people in that restaurant who had no idea that the 16-year-old kid sitting there eating was on a U.S. kill list. If the people of Hiroshima and Nagasaki deserve to die because of the acts committed by men in government, then how do Americans justify their own lives considering what the murderers in Washington, D.C. do on a daily basis? Now, the second argument that's often spouted is that by nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki, countless U.S. servicemen were spared dying in an invasion of Japan. Now, this statement assumes a land invasion was necessary or even a plausible plan. But, folks, it was neither. It was not necessary, and the plan for it that actually did exist was not a plausible plan. Now, let me explain this just a little bit. First off, it wasn't long after the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki that this was used as an excuse. And the numbers thrown around at the time were that by nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the U.S. government may have saved as many as 20 to 30,000 American lives. Then eventually that number got kicked up to about 50,000. And for a while, apologists of the nuking of these two cities claimed that the math held up to, you know, the number 50,000, that 50,000 American servicemen were spared. Now, at that stage, at 50,000, that would have made it almost crazy illogical numbers. That the whole rest of the history of World War II would dispute that number of 50,000. The more conservative number of 20 to 25,000 was probably more realistic if you have to assume an actual land invasion of Japan. But like I said, there was no reason for a land invasion of Japan. It was absolutely unnecessary. Now, that doesn't mean the U.S. government wouldn't have done it. The U.S. government does a lot of really stupid things, especially when it comes to the lives of its servicemen. But whether or not the government would have been dumb enough to invade Japan, the very most it would have cost about 20 to maybe 30,000 American lives compared to the 200,000 that were exterminated immediately by those two bombs and plus 50, 70 years of suffering that's gone on after that. it's kind of a weird thing to measure, you know, how many Americans are worth how many Japanese? How can we weigh that? What kind of a hideous scale weighs the value of American lives to the value of just Japanese citizens walking around, mothers holding babies, children walking, playing, laughing? What kind of a hideous scale do you use to measure something like that? But one way or the other, let's think about this logic here. Let's think about it from a purely cold-hearted military point of view. Was the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki necessary from a military point of view? Well, what I'm going to do now in rhetoric is called an appeal to authority. And a lot of people, especially anarchists, are very much against using the rhetorical tool of appeal to authority to make an argument, as an anarchist. Well, I think that's a mistake. Appeal to authority is where you quote some respected person, like, for example, let's say, or even if you don't quote them, if you use their argument or if you trust in their statements simply because of who they are. So let me give you an example here. Let's say Barack Obama is on television and he tells Jay Leno that, oh, no, Americans are not being spied on. Well, if you just believe that, just based on what Barack Obama says, because Barack Obama is Barack Obama, then you're appealing to authority and you're a fool. You see, because Barack Obama is lying and he's well known as doing that. We know that we're being spied on by American agencies constantly, and we have for a long time. So this is the kind of appeal to authority that is invalid in an argument. On the other hand, if you have, you know, reoccurring really bad headaches and dizzy moments and you don't know why, and so you go to your doctor and he says, well, we need to get you checked out, and he sends you to a specialist, and the specialist says, I'm sorry to tell you, but you have a brain tumor. The first thing you want to do is you want to get to another specialist and get a second opinion. And so you go to a second or maybe even a third or maybe even a fourth specialist and you get their opinion. And if they all tell you the same thing, or if mostly they tell you the same thing, then you probably ought to take them seriously. You probably ought to believe this appeal to authority. After all, it's what they do for a living. And you might want to get that, you know, taken care of. You might want to follow their advice, or at least research and find out what you can do. Well, so this is an example of appeal to authority when it's certainly in your best interest to believe what the authority has to say. All right, so now I'm going to use appeal to authority in reference to the nuking of Hiroshima and Nagasaki for purely military purposes. And in doing this, I'm going to use titles. I'm going to use proper titles. As a Quaker, I don't like doing that. But I'm going to, in this case, to emphasize exactly who it is that I'm talking about. General Douglas MacArthur, head of the Army operations in the Pacific at the time, was opposed to using the nuclear weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. He did not feel they were necessary. General Carl Spatz, head of Air Force operations in the Pacific, was opposed to nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Admiral William Leahy, chief of staff to the president, was opposed. Now here, in these three men, we have the head of Army operations, the head of Air Force operations, and the admiral who was chief of staff to the president. So we have land, air, and sea in the Pacific, the three guys whose job it was to execute the war, and they were all three opposed to nuking Hiroshima and Nagasaki. In addition to those three, General Dwight D. Eisenhower, head of Army operations in the European theater, was opposed to it. Also, former President of the United States, Herbert Hoover, vigorously attempted to keep it from happening. He tirelessly spoke to anybody who would listen to him before it happened. And afterwards, he proclaimed it to be a horrible, horrible mistake and purely unnecessary. In 1946, less than a year after the bombings, the U.S. Strategic Bombing Survey determined the Hiroshima and Nagasaki bombings were not a decisive factor in ending the war. It stated that Japan would have surrendered under any circumstances, probably no later than November 1st of 1945, but at the very worst, they would have surrendered by the end of December of 1945. They would not have held out another year. At that time, most of the political and military brass running the war agreed. In the words of Dwight David Eisenhower, the Japanese were ready to surrender and it wasn't necessary to hit them with that awful thing. That's what he called it, that awful thing. Admiral William Leahy, Chief of Staff to the President, said, quote, "The use of this barbarous weapon at Hiroshima and Nagasaki was of no material assistance in our war against Japan." Then he went on to say, "I was not taught to make war in that fashion, and wars cannot be won by destroying women and children." Well, Leahy was misinformed. You see, by the end of World War II, some 55 million civilians had been killed, whereas military deaths totaled 25 million at the very most. In other words, your odds of surviving World War II were twice as good if you wore a uniform. In his book, The Second World War, 1939 to 1945, A Strategical and Tactical History, J.F.C. Fuller, a major general and one of the century's most respected military historians, wrote in connection with the atomic bombings, and he said, "Though to save life is laudable, it in no way justifies the employment of means which run contrary to every precept of humanity and the customs of war. Should it do so, then on the pretext of shortening a war and of saving lives, any imaginable atrocity can be justified." Folks, I'm going to break right here for a commercial. Stick with me, and I'll be right back. Folks, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial. Now, I want to try to give you a little bit of a review of what the situation was like in Japan in 1945, kind of what was going on in that time frame. By the beginning of 1945, the Imperial Japanese Navy was defeated. Japan's merchant navy was essentially gone. Japan's land forces were in full retreat. Many of them were isolated and literally had nowhere left to retreat to. Japan's once mighty air force was almost non-existent, and American bombers could strike any target in Japan at will, unopposed. Japan's manufacturing capabilities were almost gone, and with no imports, the people of Japan faced starvation within the year if the war continued. And there could be no imports because Japan is a series of islands, and the U.S. completely dominated the seaways around it. Early in the year, the emperor wanted one last victory so that Japan could surrender with dignity and in a position to negotiate. In February 1945, Prince Fumimaro Kunio explained to the young Emperor Hirohito the gravity of the situation, and told him that if the war continued, the imperial family would be in greater danger from the internal revolution than from a military defeat at the hands of the Americans. The people of Japan were beaten, and they wanted peace. Their will to fight was gone. And if they had to throw out the emperor to do it, they were going to have peace. This is the situation that the emperor faced in early 1945. On June 9th, a close confidant of the emperor submitted a plan titled Draft Plan for Controlling the Crisis Situation. It was an official warning that by the end of 1945, Japan's ability to wage war would be gone and the government would be unable to control the civil unrest. This plan stated clearly that if the war continued, the emperor would be deposed at best. By authorizing this plan, the emperor was officially asking the government to surrender. By mid-June of that year, the Japanese had lost the critical Battle of Okinawa. Over 107,500 Japanese soldiers and sailors died in that battle. 10,755 Japanese soldiers and sailors either captured or surrendered, a thing unheard of. According to the official U.S. government count, 142,058 civilians were killed during the 82-day Battle of Okinawa. Now let's just look at those numbers one more time real quick. 142,000 civilians died in the Battle of Okinawa and 107,000 Japanese soldiers and sailors. The U.S. military suffered over 12,500 American deaths during that same 82-day period. The U.S. Navy took the worst of the casualties with 4,907 primarily lost from kamikaze attacks. By the end of the Battle of Okinawa, it was clear to the Japanese government that the war was over. On July 21st, 1945, the U.S. broadcast a radio message heard all over Japan stating the offer for Japan to surrender based on the Atlantic Charter. On July 25th, 4 days later, the U.S. intercepted a transmission from Japan's foreign minister, Togo, to their ambassador in Moscow, who was trying to set up a meeting with the Soviets to negotiate an end to the war. The message referred to the broadcast and stated, "Special attention should be paid to the fact that at this time the United States referred to the Atlantic Charter. As for Japan, it is impossible to accept unconditional surrender under any circumstances, but we should like to communicate to the other party through appropriate channels that we have no objection to a peace based on the Atlantic Charter." Remember, Japan never accepted an unconditional surrender. That never happened. The surrender that was signed on board the USS Missouri the following September 2nd, 1945, was not an unconditional surrender. It was essentially a surrender based on the Atlantic Charter. The government stayed in place. The emperor stayed in place. It was essentially the surrender that the Japanese had literally been begging for all year. So knowing Japan was trying to surrender, the President of the United States ordered the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On August 6th, 1945, the United States dropped an atomic bomb on the city of Hiroshima. On August 8th, 2 days later, 1945, in violation of the Soviet-Japanese Neutrality Pact, the Soviet Union declared war on Japan and began its invasion of Japan just after midnight that night. Within hours of the Soviet invasion, Japan's Supreme War Council was already meeting to discuss the incineration of civilians at Hiroshima and the invasion by the Soviets. It was their goal to format yet another attempt to surrender. That morning, Nagasaki was struck by what Eisenhower called that awful thing. No matter that the people of Japan wanted peace, no matter that the government of Japan had been begging for peace, the U.S. government saw to it that the war continued. That same day, August 9th, 1945, Harry Truman said, and I quote, "The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because We wished in this first attack to avoid, insofar as possible, the killing of civilians. Folks, every war is started with a lie. But the lies don't stop when the war stops. The lies have to continue to justify this beast we call the state. Harry Truman knew Hiroshima was not a military base. Harry Truman may have been a pretty stupid guy, but he simply wasn't that stupid. He knew the first bomb dropped on Hiroshima was intentionally aimed at the civilian population. He knew that. On August 14th, 1945, after the Emperor of Japan had ordered the surrender, the largest bombing raid in history took place. Over 1,000 American warplanes darkened the Japanese sky and continued to pound the defeated Japanese people. But before those airplanes could even return back to their home bases, the American President Harry Truman publicly announced that Japan had surrendered. As Ralph Rico has said, the destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a war crime worse than any that Japanese generals were executed for in Tokyo and Manila. If Harry Truman was not a war criminal, then no one ever was. Remember, the U.S. and the U.K. governments firebombed civilians in Dresden, Germany, for what Churchill called terrorism and political purposes. Otto Hahn, a captured Nazi scientist who had been working on Hitler's atomic program, said when he heard about Hiroshima and Nagasaki, quote, "I'm thankful that we didn't succeed." He also said, "I thank God on my bended knees that we did not make such a bomb." It's often speculated that Germany's most brilliant physicist, Werner Heisenberg, intentionally held back the Nazis' progress on making their own atomic bomb. If that's the case, the Nazi Heisenberg was a better man than those American scientists who tirelessly pushed themselves to go on and create that awful thing. Now, folks, none of the things I've said should shock you today. This is what the believers in government do. They kill people. During the Philippines insurrection in the late 1800s and the early 1900s, U.S. forces slaughtered about 200,000 Philippine civilians, dumping their bodies in mass graves and teaching the governments of the 20th century how it's done. Going back further, William Tecumseh Sherman, under the orders of Abraham Lincoln, waged war on the civilians in the South. Then when Sherman could no longer satisfy his bloodlust with the death of Southerners, he turned to his real joy in life, exterminating American Indians. Talking about such things, my brother once angered me by complaining about a blame America first mentality. I don't blame America for the slaughter of the innocent, because I'm not a collectivist. I blame individuals who acted based on the silly religious belief that government can be used for good. For America, World War II started with the president's lie. And you can go into the series I've done on war, and you can find one whole podcast just specifically on the lie that brought America into World War II. So for America, World War II started with the lie of a president. And on August 9th, 1945, as Christian children were being vaporized in St. Mary's Cathedral, the American president was claiming that Hiroshima was a military base and that the U.S. was going to avoid the killing of civilians. Folks, thanks for listening today, and remember to visit badquaker.com, where liberty is our mission. Thank you, folks.